It's time for Wants. From the Noche Jazz Cabaret in Des Moines, Iowa, it's the monthly, just-for-fun gathering of political insiders. Now, Wonks.
Oh, hello, everybody, and welcome to Wonks. Thank you for being here. We are glad that you are with us here tonight at Noche Jazz Cabaret and online for our Wonks podcast. My name is Kevin Cooney. I retired from KCCI News a couple years ago. Thanks, dear.
And I'm Dennis Goldford, professor of politics at Drake University, still there. I write books and analyze caucuses and politics, things like that, and spent a lot of years working with Kevin.
So we should explain what Wonks is just for a moment here. The story is that some of the people on this panel here, and some people who aren't here, some out in the audience, we'd get together for our Sunday morning show on KCCI and record these little segments and talk about what was going on, politics and government and whatnot. And then
we thought it might be a good idea to try taking it on the road because we had a good chemistry among ourselves and just had great fun talking about the things that when you're doing a serious broadcast of election night or news at other times, you can't really talk about.
Yeah, there were great stories that we couldn't tell on the air, so to speak. And that was when we said, this is what we should be talking about, you know. And we thought about taking it onto college campuses and stuff. And then, of course, years went by and nothing happened because that's just the way we are. But then I retired, and somebody said we should do this, and somebody added the idea of let's have it at a bar.
Those are the times in which we live. You got to drink a little bit to get through it. And we had some interesting planning meetings, and again, just the sort of spontaneous humor and stories that people would tell are wonderful, and we've got, again, a great bunch of people who are going to give you some of that storytelling, I think.
All right, so we put together this panel of some of those folks that we mentioned and a few friends that weren't still on, you know, like witness protection programs and things like this, and they are with us tonight. So let me introduce them to you and to the folks at home. Matt Strawn is the former chairman of the State Republican Party, now a partner at Next Generation Public Affairs, which he co-founded. And when he's not tossing political footballs, you might find him interested in football as well, because he is one of the co-founders of that team called the Iowa Barnstormers. Do you have Kurt Warner's phone number in your phone right there? Just curious.
Well, I don't, but I will tell you this, though, Kevin. The great thing about football as opposed to politics, well, they'll knife you in the back in politics. In football, if somebody's pissed, they're going to give you their seat number and their name. So you know.
All right.
Here we go. Ann Roth comes from a very active political family in Iowa. Her late father, Luke, was a well-known Republican administrator with Chuck Grassley, Greg Ganske, and the George W. Bush campaign. Ann got the bug and is, among other things, a former finance director at the Charles Grassley campaign. Let's have it for Ann. Emily Parcell has an impressive resume in Democratic politics. She was political director of the Barack Obama caucus campaign in 2008, and she's now a principal at Wildfire Contact, but she got back into the weeds of the everyday campaigns as an advisor to the Hillary Clinton Iowa campaign.
And in this corner, Matt Paul ran the Iowa caucus campaign for Hillary Clinton in 2016, and that was after he spent about 7 years running the communications operations for U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack, for whom he worked when Vilsack was governor and running for governor as well. Let's see, also very active going back into the Howard Dean campaign.
Yeah, thanks, Kevin. Thanks for bringing that up.
Oh, I could bring up stuff.
Oh, I know.
He is now a senior vice president of public affairs at Cornerstone Government Affairs. Matt Paul. Back over on this table, we have two very well-known journalists to make this whole evening semi-legit, I guess you could say.
Ish.
David. Yeah, fake news.
David Yepsen is known to anyone and everyone involved in Iowa politics, longtime reporter and columnist for the Des Moines Register, currently host of Iowa Public Television and the Iowa Press. And that was after he served director of the Paul Simon Public Policy Institute at Southern Illinois University. David Yepsen.
And last and certainly not least is Kay Henderson. She's been a news voice of Radio Iowa since the 1980s. As a matter of fact, she helped start Radio Iowa News, and she was literally born to cover politics because the day she was born was an election day. Can't get away from it. Kay is also a regular panelist on Iowa Press.
So the question is, where do we begin with all this? And I think the answer is probably at the beginning, so to speak, for some of the people who are here. And we want to talk to them about why they got into this crazy business to begin with. And Emily, you were telling a story that I think would be great to start off with. Emily Parcell.
Yeah, well, my first paid job in politics was for the Iowa Democratic Party as a paid canvasser. So if anybody in here has been a paid canvasser, good job. And one of my very first doors, the first week that we were out door knocking, I had this lovely woman. She was probably 89 years old. I was surprised that she was living in her house. But her and her husband invited me in because that's what you do. They invite you into their homes. And she insisted on showing me her scar from her open heart surgery, which she removed her clothing. It was a very impressive scar, and you know, it stayed with me, and I was just hooked from that moment on.
Obviously it stayed with you.
Yeah.
You were scarred by getting involved in politics, weren't you?
Yeah, yes. Literally.
Okay, Anne, what about you? How'd you start?
Well, I know some people out in the audience are cradle Catholics. I was literally a cradle politics person. My parents met on Senator Grassley's campaign. My mom, who's in the audience tonight, love you. Let's give her a hand. She was working for Tom Stoner, who was Senator Grassley's primary opponent, and she would beat my dad to every single event that Stoner and Grassley were to talk to or to speak at, and she would put big campaign signs behind the podium. And so whenever, you know, when Stoner was speaking, there would be a Grassley sign behind him. And so anyway, of course, we know that Stoner lost and Grassley won, and my dad took her out to lunch and asked her to be on the campaign, and the rest is history. So Grassley likes to attribute my birth to himself, which is partly true. And it's a little bit how I would attribute it to Stoner's loss, which he would love even more because he's so competitive. But I went out to school and in DC, lived there and worked there for a while, got involved with Grassley, and they asked me to come back and do the finance, and that's kind of how I got involved. So I didn't think I was political, but I was from the beginning, I guess, so.
It was destiny.
Yeah, right. Well, I did throw, I threw candy at a very young age at parades. Yeah, Dad would take us to every single parade we had to go to for Gansky, Lightfoot, anybody and everybody, so maybe that's how I got started. Yeah, that's why I like candy so much. I don't know.
We mentioned it in passing, but Kay, you were born on Election Day.
Yes, I was.
There's a story involved with that. Can you tell that? Has the statute of limitations expired?
Yes, and my parents are no longer with us, so they can't verify any of this.
Which makes it even better.
Exactly.
Doesn't?
But I was born in the middle of the night, apparently. My mother was 46, my dad was 52. They got on the elevator at the Creston Hospital, and the nurse who happened to be riding in the elevator said to them, "I'm sorry, the grandparents have to wait in the waiting room." At which point my mother informed this, I feel sad for this person actually, my mother informed her that she was the one having the baby. I'm pretty sure that my dad broke election laws because he went to the Lenox High School gymnasium to be an election judge and count ballots, and during his lunch hour, he took my mother a ballot in the hospital so that she could vote. So that might invalidate the Johnson landslide in 1964. I, I grew up on a farm, and that's been really great because I'm used to being in a livestock pen. And I would like to thank the folks that you're hearing from that are the political class, because they tend to put the reporters in livestock pens. If you go to the Iowa State Fair and you walk among the hogs, because who doesn't want to do that, you'll notice that there are these steel cages in which they put the animals. And so those are the same cages that when you go to a George W. Bush event or a Donald Trump event or a Barack Obama event, you see us in those same cages.
And they look at reporters very suspiciously, too, mm-hmm. both parties.
But they're not electrified, I don't think, right?
Unless you're Fred Thompson, you don't wear Gucci's to the Iowa State Fair.
Right, right. All right, Jepson, tell them how you started.
I grew up in a small Iowa town, flunked Little League, too little to do football or basketball, was lousy at band. Now, if you can't do sports and band in a small Iowa town, you're pretty much SOL. But I did like the debate team, and so I did that, and speech contests and all that sort of thing, student government, and thought, well, you know, it might be fun to have a career in politics. Went to the University of Iowa, figured out pretty quickly that the only people really having any fun in a campaign were the reporters, because the day after the election, they still had a job, and that's where I am today.
Matt Strawn, what's your excuse?
Yeah. And why am I here? We should talk about that. You know, I wasn't reared at the elbow of Chuck Grassley or anyone like that. I didn't throw candy. I was at the University of Iowa, and I've always been a little contrarian, so I thought Republican politics and conservatism was for me, you know, having spent some time in Iowa City. Did an internship in Washington, D.C., and as a 20-year-old farm kid from Van Horn, Iowa, I found myself on the steps of the United States Capitol during the Contract with America ceremony, actually, and that was the political bug stuck. So I returned back to Iowa City, became the token conservative columnist at the Daily Iowan. You have not lived until you were the token conservative columnist at the Daily Iowan. And, you know, from there on, you know, I decided, you know, spent about a decade in Washington, D.C. before we returned home and had some fun.
Matt Paul, do you have a story of you've had an illustrious career?
Not really.
Okay. Tell us about some of the less than illustrious moments.
Well, I was a speech and drama major at Mount Mercy College. I got a scholarship there. I really didn't have a choice where I went to college. My uncle is here, T. Donnellan Collins, who was a priest at the time. And so I had to go to Catholic school. I got into Luther by the grace of God and UNI, and they said, no, you got to go to Mount Mercy.
And see, Luther is not Catholic.
I know. It's
Luther. Weird, isn't
Emily,
it?
Emily, yeah. The details nobody cares about. I was a speech and drama major, and I worked at WMT. It was WMT-TV then in Cedar Rapids, and then at a country radio station. And did the news, and I was like, oh, this media business is too crazy. There's no continuity in it. I've got to get out of this and get into politics. That's a nice, stable business. And that was 35 years ago, and I've just been very blessed. And worked for a governor and a senator and a cabinet member, and here I am talking to you, Kevin.
He worked at the USDA.
I did.
He worked at the USDA.
I did.
You know more about agriculture than Sam Clovis.
Thank you.
Too soon.
How much is that really saying, though? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a low bar.
You know, there's an old saying in Hollywood business, TV, and whatever, and that is don't follow animals and children. And there have been some interesting... you know,
where are you going with this, Kevin?
I'm trying to help Dennis get into this thing.
Well, Matt,
from an animal or children's standpoint,
yes,
Kevin.
Matt, tell us about petting zoos.
Well, that's both.
Well, I was just going to say, so much for burying the lead. It is a little known fact. Actually, how many of you know this? In the hours before the 2011 straw poll, we had a major crisis that put into question whether or not we'd actually be able to pull the last straw poll off. All right, I don't see any hands. So it tells me that the Bachman for President campaign is well represented here tonight.
Yeah. So,
it came to our attention 24 hours before the 2011 straw poll that Michelle Bachman planned on having a petting zoo outside of Hilton Coliseum at her tent. No, I'm not making this up. And in the service, it got so bad, in the service contract that the Republican Party of Iowa had with Iowa State University, we were arguing as to whether or not they were service and comfort animals.
Oh my gosh.
Suffice to say, we won the argument, so there was no petting zoo. They had to settle for Randy Travis. and the rest is history.
Indeed it is. And it's not just the animals and I don't know, children or whatever. But Emily, you had an experience, I believe, with Oprah Winfrey. So talk about some celebrities, if we could open that can of worms.
Yeah. Well, so as you do when you're running for president, you bring in petting zoos or Oprah. So we fortunately fell on the side of Oprah. And it was very helpful. You know, we talked about this. I do think, you know, we built lists off it. We were as strategic as possible. But the lead up to the Oprah events in, this would have been late 2007, maybe it was January, I don't remember. I know my car broke down on the way to staff it, so
it was December.
You get a car.
Oprah did not give her a car.
It was very clearly communicated to us on the staff that we were, one, not to look her directly in the eye.
Can't look her in the
cannot.
Eye.
Cannot, no.
Wait,
Oprah
wait a minute,
is a
not
thing.
Look her in the eye?
It's a hologram, maybe, I don't know.
Could you
it was very, it was
could
very.
You, could you touch her robe or anything?
No,
it's
no.
It's like the
we
queen
had to call
in
her.
England.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way to describe it. We could not look her in the eye. We could look her in the eye, but I didn't want to. And then also, we had to call her Miss Winfrey. We could not call her Oprah. And I mean, my entire life, she'd been called Oprah. So that was, like re-socialize yourself, Miss Winfrey. And so I was at the event in Cedar Rapids. I was not here at the Des Moines event. Many of you might have been at the Des Moines event. I was at the event in Cedar Rapids, and we had a hold room for the Obamas. And we had a hold room for Oprah and Gail. Gail was with her. Gail is lovely. I do watch the CBS Morning News because of Gail. And I like, you know, Charlie's good too. And Nora, they're all great. But anyway, of course, this being the Obama campaign, Paul Tews was not following the rules. Anybody who knows Paul would know this, and you're not surprised. He had run like a bootleg competition among the field organizers the week before Oprah's events, letting them know that anybody who, the person who had the most voter contacts that week would get their picture taken with Miss Winfrey. This was not in the agreement with Miss Winfrey or whoever we had our contract with. So I was caught behind the stage in Cedar Rapids trying to figure out how am I going to get this lovely field organizer's photo with Miss Winfrey, who I'm not supposed to speak directly to or look directly in the eye. And thank God for Gail, because she came out of the hold room and was chatting everybody up, and I explained the situation, and she was lovely. And when Miss Winfrey exited the hold room, Gail steered her over to my volunteer, who was very excited, did the quick photo. Gail even held the camera herself, took the picture, handed me the camera, and they went on and did the event. So thank God for Gail. She saved the event. And Oprah was helpful as well.
Miss Winfrey.
Miss Winfrey,
Miss
yes.
Winfrey.
Right.
Kay, you were at the Des Moines event.
I was. I believe Mr. Yepsen was as well. The interesting thing about it was the livestock pen was probably the highest livestock pen I've ever been on. It was a stairway to heaven, if you will. And the most interesting thing about being there to cover it was the number of Republicans I tried to interview as they came into the venue who said, oh, I don't want you to interview you. I can't do it because I don't want people to know I'm here. Because I believe there were about 10,000 people at this event. And I can't really see the crowd, but I promise not to out you tonight if you were there. And I tried to interview you.
That's why I said many of you are probably there. That was a bipartisan statement.
Is there a game-changing moment for any of you that you remember negatively or positively? A moment that made everything change that you David, you
well, I don't know
want to go.
A game changer, but I think that event you guys have been talking about, that JJ dinner, Barack Obama gave one of the best speeches political speeches I've ever heard, and I've heard a few. It was powerful. It was moving. I think anyone who was there. How many people were there at that? I see a few hands. You could tell something had happened in that race, and I told some friends of mine, Dan Balls, at the Washington Post, said I think this caucus contest may be over, and it was, because you could tell by the look in the faces of the Hillary Clinton people that Obama had done very well. So, you know, that was just one of the best political speeches I ever heard, and I remember that for a long time.
And this is Kay. One of the interesting things about that event is apparently Barack Obama does not hold a grudge, because one of the most interesting lines that Joe Biden ever said in Iowa was when he got to the center stage at JJ in 2007, he said to the crowd that was cheering his entry, "Hello, Chicago." And that didn't really go over well with some of the Obama people who were in the crowd.
I remember telling that.
Behind
when
the scenes.
Obama's first visit to Iowa, after he announced in Springfield he came to Iowa and he did an event, I think it was in Waterloo or Cedar Rapids.
Cedar Rapids.
And he started taking questions from the audience. First guy gets up, he's from Naperville. Second guy gets up, he's from Chicago. Ask him about the White Sox or something. And I turned to Axelrod and said, "What, do you salt the crowd?" And Obama people were pretty freaked out because they needed some Iowans to stand up. And Iowans, of course, were very deferential. And if you know anything about people in Chicago, they're not deferential. And if it got their elbows out, and that was an embarrassment to Obama campaign right out of the box. First question in Iowa was from some guy from Naperville.
But, David, how many people were there? How many people were that kind of
high school? Huge crowd.
You know, it was like 2,500 people.
Illinois.
Okay, thanks, Bill Clinton.
I don't remember. I don't remember I was there. I don't remember the I don't remember the first questions from the audience because I was mortified that I hadn't recognized by sight Dick Durbin, and I tipped off the advance people and said, "There's this guy in a suit over here who's not supposed to be here." He was like back toward the press pen, and the advance guy said, "That's Senator Durbin. He's okay. He can be wherever he wants."
Well, you know, going to that event, they loaded a couple of us on the school bus.
Yeah.
Helped some students coming up there. And I remember it was very cold that day.
Yeah. February
6th. He's getting off. He's got nothing on his head. And Michelle is giving him grief about, "Get something on over those ears." And I looked at those ears and say, "Yeah, you know, he's really good." But he didn't. Those ears of his had to have been frozen by the time he got into the event.
Well, Kevin, you asked about a life-changing moment.
Yeah,
I don't know if this is quite life-changing, but you talking about Gail, all of us on this side have been a handler for our candidates. And one time being a handler, meaning you literally handle the candidate, you get them from one place to another. Oprah is a candidate in this case. Gail mm-hmm. was her handler.
Yep.
So, and also a life-changing moment. So I'm staffing Senator Grassley at the Iowa State game. And it happens to be in 2015, which we looked up, was a 2:35 game time. And we're tailgating. We're tailgating. I use that term in the literal. There's a lot of tailgates out, and we're
Senator
walking.
Grassley brought cookies.
Yeah, right. As most of the people in the room know, he's a teetotaler, has never had a sip of alcohol, and so we're doing this for of course political purposes, walking around saying hello to people. And it's getting late into the day, and as everybody knows how Iowa City runs. People
this was
in Iowa.
3:15 in
the this was Iowa City. Yeah,
that's
people
brave.
Are getting. Pretty toasted. And so we're walking and I see the stadium, but we've got a long way to go. And these people just keep coming up towards him just in mass. And I know I said I was a cradle Catholic in the beginning. This is the closest to Jesus Christ I've ever been, you guys. I mean, he's walking and people are just like coming at him from all levels. And finally, this mirrors the exact story that Emily started this whole thing off with. A man who is very inebriated, takes off his Iowa shirt, and he's got a big beer belly, and he hands it to Senator Grassley. He's like, "Go Iowa!" And I'm like the handler, and I'm like, "Thank you very much, sir." And I just stiff arm him right out of the picture. The Heisman, thank you, thank you. Excuse me. I didn't go to Iowa. You can tell that.
Do you want to show you his open heart surgery scar?
Yeah, no. I wouldn't let him stick around that long. But anyway, yeah, that just was a moment for me.
Matt Straw, there was a moment that you told me once about that happened at a precinct caucus. It wasn't the grand scale type of changing moment, but it changed that caucus, right?
Well, it also doesn't involve a topless activist. So, you know, well, I know earlier we were talking about the 2008 caucus and obviously the monumental shift that happened in the Obama campaign, but, you know, people forget on the Republican side and, well, that very, very cold January 3rd when all the focus was on Emily and Matt's side of the aisle. You know, I'm up in my precinct caucus up in Ankeny, literally the Ankeny Country Club precinct. And, you know, you've got, of course, right? Yeah, thank you, Matt.
Do you have that in the pro shop?
Right, well, we do.
The club room, where do you have that?
They didn't have to spill out onto the green.
Yeah, no, it's better than that. You know, we got the Farm Bureau president, the state rep in town, you know, all that good stuff.
Speechifying.
So we're doing our speeches, standing up like everybody does. You know, I ended up giving the speech for John. Of course, Mitt Romney had some congressman from out of state come in and give his speech. Ron Paul had some crank from Kansas City drive up to give his speech. And, oh, it was gold standard. It was brilliant. Maybe auditing the Fed, too. So, and of course, no one was there for Fred Thompson. And then as we're getting ready to vote, all of a sudden somebody ambles in that none of us had ever seen, this crazy, well-connected precinct up in Ankeny, and goes, "Hey, I think I'm here to give a speech for Mike Huckabee." We all kind of look at each other. All right, you know, have at it, Hoss. And he gives
us... Did you say Hoss? Well, did you say Hoss out loud?
No, because it's a country club precinct.
Okay, got it.
So, it's one of the
you're
band
all wearing
words.
Navy blazers.
So we're all, yeah, it's like
you are tonight.
Yeah, it's like Rush Week, Matt. So this guy who none of us have ever seen gives this you know, economic conservative precinct this speech that he closes with. Just remember, with Mike Huckabee, you're putting the GOD back in the GOP. And Huckabee carried our precinct. And little did we know, that was happening all around the state that night. So,
we got some.
And on that note, before we get to Matt Paul, we're going to take a break for just a moment.
All right. We'll be back with more Wonks after this.
Noche is Iowa's premier home for jazz and cabaret. Open Wednesday through Saturday and hosting performers local and national, Noche's throwback cocktail bar and stage ensure a night unlike any other in Central Iowa.
Every night I just bide my time till you are with me again.
Whether it's a night out for a show or throwing your next private event backstage, visit NocheDSM.com for more information right away. That's NocheDSM.com.
Hey, everybody, we're back. Welcome back, everybody. Wonks is back, and we want to thank you for being with us. And thanks again to the folks at Noche for letting us hang out at their place. Can we have a... Yeah. Hey, Matt Paul?
Yes.
Some strange things I know have happened to you because over the years you've told me about them.
Wow.
On the campaign trail, that is.
Wow. Yeah.
There was one story that happened, where was it, Cedar Rapids, early on in the Clinton campaign?
Was you mean the Cedral Supper Club incident? Well, it was Hillary's first trip, which we had worked very hard, and I was very proud of this event. We started in Monticello, Iowa, in Jones County. And we made sure we didn't want this big... when Hillary first came to Des Moines in 2008, 2007, technically, every rental car in Des Moines was taken by that trip. True story. And so we sent from the beginning, from the first time I took that job... I said, I want to keep this footprint small. I'm going to keep this. If staff doesn't have to be there, if they don't have a job, if they're not talking or engaging with an Iowan or signing up in an Iowan, I don't want them there. So we kept this, you know, and the Secret Service worked very hard as a former First Lady to keep the footprint small, and everything went fine until we did these off-the-record sort of coffees where we didn't tell the people who were coming to coffee that they were coming to coffee with Hillary Clinton. Sort of like, hey, do you want to get coffee?
With Matt Paul?
James Smith in Scott County? She's like, who the hell is Matt Paul? It's like, fine. Hey, by the way, you're going to get in this unmarked car, and we're going to take your cell phone from you and put you in this car. Anyway, we may have overthought this slightly. But we went to dinner that night on our way to Council Bluffs because Hillary was flying commercially out of Omaha. And we had dinner that night at one of my favorite restaurants, and my favorite restaurant in Iowa, called the Sedrel Supper Club, which, as many people in this room know, is about 15 miles outside of Cedar Rapids.
Great relish trays.
Unbelievable. David, now the seventh time you've made that point. We've got the point on the relish tray.
You can tell I like relish trays.
But the chicken livers are amazing. Anyway, it's a great place. Hillary loved this place.
Delicacy.
We go there. We're there. And some reporter finds out we're there and pulls up this story about the Sedrel Motel, which was located outside of this, which is outside of the city limits of Cedar Rapids, which is the only place that people who are on the sex offender registry can live. So I have the New York Times and the Washington Post asking about this, and I was like, dude, we just want to go to dinner with real people.
When are you rolling out your policy on sex offenders?
Brother, well, stick to the pizza
thanks,
ranch.
Thanks.
Stick to the pizza ranch. You never have this problem.
Emily.
Yes, we do.
Emily, whose team are you on?
Well, I mean, I'm hearing the calls come in.
Anyway.
What does this say about your position?
It was tremendous. We may have gotten to the bottom of the fact that the Sedrel Supper Club is a separate LLC of the Sedrel Motel.
You're explaining, you're losing, Paul.
Okay. Okay. Thanks.
You know,
what is that?
Hey, go ahead.
It was all downhill.
It's a technical knockout, is what it is.
The very first event, though, was in Monticello.
Jones County.
Exactly.
Hey, you know that.
Exactly. So someone who is a reporter based in New York City telephoned me in Des Moines and said, I'm flying into Des Moines. Can I get a taxi to Monticello? No. And I said, no, you'll have to rent a car. And he said, well, I don't have a driver's license. Do you think I could, is there like a train or a bus that I could, no, this is a real conversation I had with someone. And so his news organization, which you would recognize were I to tell you what the news organization.
Why wouldn't you say what the news, if you're going to set it up like that, you should say it.
No, I'm not going to.
Oh,
I'm goodness. Keeping my sources.
Oh, well, you can't because you're on that side of
exactly,
the table.
Exactly. It was a confidential conversation, but can you imagine thinking how big
what
Iowa
that,
is?
What would that? Can you imagine getting the Des Moines airport and saying, like, hey, you're just going to go over to Jones County.
Walking to the curb.
It'd be like a $40 taxi ride.
Right.
My favorite story like along those lines, I had to do a guest appearance on a CNN thing, and it was out at Iowa Public Television. I'm coming from downtown. That's about a 25-minute trip. The traffic was awful. And along on I-235, so I could tell I wasn't going to get there. They always want you in the chair 20 minutes ahead of time. But I knew I could.
They
want to
do makeup
and make
you look good.
I knew I could get there in time to what's called the hit time to do the interview. So I called a guy, the producer in Atlanta. I said, "Listen, I'm not. I'll make it, but I'm stuck in traffic, and I'm just going to make it barely in time." And he said, "You're what?" I said, "I'm stuck in traffic." And he said, "In Des Moines, Iowa." Yeah.
You can tell from what several people have said so far, of course, that food is very important in political campaigns. And there's some interesting stories that folks have in that regard. But you can think back, if you've ever gone to a Republican straw poll when they had them up in Ames, that was just a huge buffet, and all the candidates had to spring for all this food.
And how much did you eat?
I sampled barbecue at times. Okay. But if you remember in 2004, and this is Dennis speaking, of course, I think it was 2004, caucuses were on the Monday night, and the New York Times was so written out with everything with regard to the caucuses that below the fold that morning, they had a schematic drawing of the major steakhouse here in downtown Des Moines. I don't know if we can say the name or not.
Go ahead.
Okay, 801 Grand.
Are they a sponsor?
Hey,
Cooney, get on that.
They are now.
I love a scrappy burger as much as the next guy.
They were the holy place of worship for all these out-of-town reporters, and they had a schematic drawing, and they showed where all the political people and all the media stars were sitting in this diagram. So food was even a story in the New York Times at that
Matt Paul lives at 801
He's the
Grand.
Mayor.
I happen to know
the
mayor.
He's the ward precinct boss of 801.
But were you on that diagram by any chance?
No, I wasn't. It killed me.
Well, think of ridiculous moments about food. Anne, start us off with some ridiculous moment about food in campaigns.
Sure. So this was my first ever fundraiser with Senator Grassley. It was still in D.C. So I lived out there after college, got hired on, and I am there in this, you know, in a row house in Washington with probably, I don't know, 15, 17 people. It's a breakfast. Senator Grassley does breakfasts, okay, because they're cheap and they're in the morning. So he doesn't do them in the evening.
Nobody expects booze.
No, exactly. No. That's another thing. Good point. And so I'm kind of sitting, I'm a little bit of a wallflower at that point, and I'm just trying to take it all in, and Barbara Grassley comes. And so we're all there, and things are wrapping up. And as people are still sitting at the table having a conversation, you know, Barbara Grassley flags over one of the waitresses and says, "Hey, you know, can you bring a to-go container? And I mean, this waiter had no idea probably what that even was. They're like, usually we just throw it away. And she's like, no, bring me something like with plastic or a Ziploc. And so I'm like running around because I'm the person, you know, looking for it. She proceeds to, and I love her and I hope she hears this, takes it from the middle of the table and starts putting the rolls in the to-go container so that she can bring them home to D.C. or in Iowa. And when she's not here, they freeze them and Senator Grassley can eat them during the week.
Well, or reuse them at a later event.
It's Iowa, right?
Yeah.
That's true. No. I saw her do the same thing in Houston at the Republican convention. Picking up the rolls after everybody had gone and taking them up to the room.
Well, Dennis, before we defer to the mayor of 801, so, you know, actually hold out the bucket, Paul. I'm about to drop a bunch of names.
We're at
801 before caucus night in 2012. It happens to be New Year's Eve. I think it was New Year's Eve, or maybe it was New Year's Day. It was a Saturday night, and I'm doing Meet the Press the next morning. So,
well, la-di-da.
Right? Wasn't that artful how that was worked in with the Hit Times in New York? So we've got all the, you know, it's David Gregory and Mike Murphy and Heilman and David Brooks and all the gang that's there. And
not anymore. None of those people are still there.
I didn't go Halperin.
Okay.
So I get up about halfway through dinner and start walking across 801, and I hear, Strawn, get your ass over here. And I look up, and it is three Fox News personalities, current Fox News personalities. They, you know, kind of give me one of these, you know, motion me over. And I go, what? He goes, what are you doing with those NBC punks? Get your ass over here where you belong.
Matt Paul, is it still that way? Is it? Over here.
Center square for the win. Matt
no,
Paul.
I'm paying attention. Who clapped at that?
Is
Amy.
Is it 801 still a power...
No.
Position?
Well,
or?
I don't know. I like it. It's good food. I like the people in there. It's comfortable.
But it is true that, Kevin, it is true that 801 is on the National Register of Historic Places as the birthplace of conventional wisdom in American
great
politics.
That's a great line, Jepson. That's right. That's your best line ever.
And
At least I've got one.
It is, David. It's your best lineup.
The old place was Guido's at the Hotel Savory, and that was a great place. The only problem with going to was
what
Guido's.
About, was Babe's ever that or not? Babe's was never that.
Well, it was sort of, but that was more of a lunch place. I just remember going to Guido's with Jack Germain and Ken Bodie one time. We had to divide up we told the server at the beginning, you know, well, he's getting the food and Yepsen here will get the bar bill. That was a losing bet with Jack Germain, I'll tell you that.
Why Pizza Ranch, Strawn? Why Pizza Ranch?
Because some of us are still fiscal conservatives. So my history with the Pizza Ranch, this goes back to when I was first running for chair in December of 2008 into January of 2009. So we'd come off a losing election, and, well, I was running against actually someone who had been the chairman of Mike Huckabee's campaign, so I knew I couldn't go to the Pizza Ranches. So I've got to come up with something a little more creative. So, you know, I decide, you know what we're going to do for my town hall, tell everybody why I'd be a great chairman? We're going to do the local joints. So we're talking the Pizza King in Council Bluffs. We're talking Happy Joe's in Davenport. We're talking the OP in Clear Lake. So we put all this together. Well, here's the thing you don't get when you go to the Pizza Ranch. Well, I'll get to this. So my stop in Dubuque, I'm at the Shot Tower. I don't know if anybody's been to the Shot Tower in Dubuque. It's downtown, great joint. So at all these events, you know, I throw some pictures of Pop out there, throw a couple pizzas, give my spiel and say, hey, if you like what you heard, talk to your central committee guys and have them vote for me. So after the election, I'm settling up my credit card bill and I look and, well, I'll be darned, the one in Dubuque cost me three times the amount of any of the stops I did around the state. So I'm like, this can't be right. So I call up the folks at Shot Tower, said, hey, I think there's some discrepancy on the bill. So they were able to actually pull the record and go, well, no, they sent me the bill. Yeah. Every Republican in Dubuque at my town hall was putting beer on my tab when I was up there. So, like, these guys are my kind of Republicans. So we carried that section of the state, but I would have been better off with the Pizza Ranch, Kevin.
Kay Henderson, what do reporters do about food on the campaign trail?
Nothing. We don't eat their food.
You're not allowed?
No,
matter of professional ethics?
Well,
what do you do?
And sometimes it really doesn't smell good. There's a particular venue that the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition likes to use. And during the state fair, the venue is used for baby animals to be welcomed into the world. And, you know, just a few short weeks later, the Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition has a huge banquet there. And they bring in plantation fried chicken from that place that's not sponsoring us, unless you want me to say Hy-Vee, and they might buy an advertisement. But the combined smell of that plantation fried chicken and the remnants from the Iowa State Fair just is not appetizing.
I have favorite food stories. Hillary Clinton in the 2007 campaign. So I said, look, I need some time with the candidate. Well, yeah, fine. So we'll meet up at the Drake Diner. And it was in the evening, and they come rolling in there. And this was shortly after she got burned for not leaving a tip. So two things about that. One is, when everybody left, I think there was about $60 worth of tips on the table. I left some, she left some. But I made a note in a column. I wrote a column about it, had this interview, all this policy wonk stuff. And I made the mention that over a lunch or a dinner of chocolate malt and French fries at the Drake Diner, and that was like an eighth or ninth graph. And I put that in the paper. It was before Twitter. And the next day, I'm getting all these calls from people. What kind of malt, you know, and what did she have? Did she eat cheese on those French fries? And that was all really the media people could care about, was that color bit about what Hillary Clinton was even and who left the tip.
That's what's important.
In 1987, leading up to the 88 campaign, was out with Joe Biden, and we wound up at 11:30 at night in Carroll, Iowa, at the Carrollton Inn. And rolling in there, and there was the senator, and I was along, I think, one aide. There were maybe four of us. And we come rolling in there at 11:30 at night. We're all famished. And we asked the clerk, you know, is there someplace to get something to eat? And he goes, at this hour? I mean, yeah. Well, he said, there's a Godfather's Pizza down the street. Okay. And one of the aides says, well, I'll call a cab. And the clerk looks at him and says, you're not going to get a cab.
Carroll, Iowa?
So the clerk says, well, here. And he reaches in his pocket and he pulls out his keys. So take my car. But you have to be back by midnight. I got a date. So Biden.
That's great, David.
Biden takes these keys, and we get in this guy's car, and it's one of those jacked up. There was a judge, they were called. Pontiac made him. He had little furry balls around and the dice. So here's a United States senator, a couple of reporters, and an aide. And Joe Biden, Biden knew what he was doing with that car. I mean, this is Joe Sixpack.
Right.
And we roar off the deserted streets of Carroll, Iowa, to Godfather's Pizza, and we shoveling it in. And Biden is very, you know, we got to get this, got to get back for this kid. Gets him a pizza. We get in the car. We go back. Biden handing the kid a pizza and the keys and says, thank you very much. And it's a great story. I wrote it. I wrote a little column about that. And I got a call one Monday morning. And Mr. Yepsen, I was a clerk at that hotel when you guys came. I married that woman.
That's a good story.
I don't know if you're a regular reader of Esquire magazine, but one of the things that's going on, is published on Esquire magazine, is what happened election night 2016. And featured quite prominently in that article is one Matt Paul. What happened that night? I mean, we all know what happened that night, but I mean, what happened that night?
Oh, I dropped a lot of F-bombs that night, which you'll read about. My mother's not happy about. It was a grueling, god-awful, horrific, long night. Not totally without surprise. But
really?
No, no. Like, we knew we had problems in Florida. We, like, if you look at, like, where Kane was, we spent a lot of time in Florida. We spent a lot of time in Wisconsin, a lot of time in Pennsylvania, a lot of time in Ohio. We saw these crowds. We knew we had some issues there. We saw things that maybe the top of the ticket had not seen, that had not popped through the numbers. I have my notes from the last polling call we did the Sunday night. We did it with Senator Tammy Baldwin in Wisconsin at a community college in suburban Milwaukee in the cafeteria manager's office. And I keep those notes, and my colleagues have seen those notes because it's humility. And it says, don't ever think you know this business because you don't. You don't know this business.
Did it show Wisconsin?
It showed that Florida was okay. It showed Pennsylvania was okay. It showed that North Carolina was okay. It was wrong. We were wrong. And you need to admit that. And you need to learn from it and move on.
Dave Yepsen and then others, please jump in. Aside from the particular tactical aspects of 2016, what do we learn about American politics after the 2016 election?
Well, there's a populist mood there. I think the best way to describe it is the politics of resentment. We've all heard about the income inequality issues, but we're dividing ourselves in this country into haves and have-nots. There are a lot of angry people in the electorate, people who have been left behind, who feel like the country is changing, the culture is changing. They're not part of it. They're afraid of it, or they disagree with it. I think that it was a wake-up call for all of us, including this reporter. I wasn't covering that campaign, but what I feel like was I forgot where I came from. That if you go back to the streets of my hometown of Jefferson, Iowa, you could have talked to people and you could have seen what we were all surprised about. And that continues in the electorate today. I mean, President Trump's in big political, his job approval rating is bad, but I don't know very many people that think his base is cracked over any of this. This Russia stuff is over their heads, and they don't care about it. It's irrelevant to their lives, and there's a protest movement. Dennis, you had a very good line, and I heard you talking the other night, that Donald Trump becomes the middle finger. Many Americans saying to the establishment what they think, and that was a big wake-up call. We're not through sorting it all out, but it will have real implications for 2018 and 2020. I know.
Well, that brings me, Emily Parcell. Where do the Democrats go in 2018?
Well, I was going to comment on what David was talking about.
Fire away.
A couple of comments. I think, you know, he hit the nail on the head about the Jefferson Iowas of the world. And I saw an interview recently within the last week or 10 days where, you know, a member of Congress was on a national political show news panel, and they were talking about how they connect with small town voters. And this particular member of Congress spends time every Saturday in their local grocery store. And they're there to talk to, you know, people who are there grocery shopping on a Saturday. And they were talking about how they always ask everybody that they meet two questions. It's a former journalist, and they specialized for a while in investigative journalism, so they're very good at asking questions that sort of get to a different question. And the two questions they ask are, did you go on vacation this year, and what do you do for fun? And they ask those questions so that they don't have to ask the people, how much do you make? So they can find out, how are people really living their day-to-day lives out here? And they told the national press panel that particular weekend they had talked to a full-time healthcare nurse. She was a nurse in a local, you know, just rural small-town hospital. And her husband was also employed full-time. And she said they hadn't gone on vacation for the last couple of years. And what they did for fun was watch cable TV. And she said, you know, because they can't afford to take their kids to the movies. And that's the thing that people are missing. And I know we're supposed to be having fun, but I do think it's an important point to make that we've talked a lot about the Iowa caucuses, and there are a lot of great things about the caucus, and we joked about having events in people's living rooms. But where else do these candidates for the White House have to come talk to that family in Jefferson, Iowa, who can't afford to take their kids to the movies? That's why I think that, you know, this thing has gotten so huge, and the digital news cycle and the five-minute news cycle, you know, it can really distort things. But bringing people back to the basics, and I think, to your question, Kevin, about where the Democrats go in 2018, I think we have to refocus our conversations on those people. And we have to show, one, not only do we understand, but we have a plan for you. And it's not only that, you know, we get the culture, we get what you're going through, but we also have something that we want to offer you, that we can give you hope again. That word hope, you know, I kind of think that Trump and Obama were two different sides of the same coin. It was very emotional, and Obama's appealed to hope, and Trump's appealed to anger. And there's no reason that hope can't work again, but you gotta actually speak to it.
Yeah, and Dennis, and you know, I want to speak to you. The initial question to kind of start things is, why'd you get into this? Why do you do it? And we're riding high right now as Republicans. There's no question, electorally at least. We've got some challenges in solving problems. Of course.
Are signs here.
That's right. No. Yeah, applause.
Come on, other side of the room.
But no. Here's where I'm going with this on the why do you do it, and the challenges that are out there in society writ large. And I think back to this was about a week and a half before the election, about a year ago, last November. And it happened to be a day when I was home. So when I'm home, I take the kids to Holy Trinity. I drop them off at school, and we do the carpool for the neighbors. HT. Beaverdale, give it up. So, that's right. Yeah, I think we're the only Republican family in HT, but be that as it may. So, this particular day, the neighbor family had just had a child, so had a baby. So, we're driving in, and I hear my 12-year-old in the back of the car as they're having a conversation about where he was born. He goes, well, yeah, I was born in Virginia, and now I've learned now as a parent, when I'm driving, I keep my mouth shut and my ears open, because I learn more that way. But I hear my son say he was born in Virginia, which I know is patently false. Why?
because I was there in Sibley Hospital in Northwest Washington, D.C. when he was born. So fast forward to the end of the night, we get home, and I go, Nate, buddy, I couldn't help but overhear you telling Caleb you were born in Virginia. Why did you say that when you know it's not true? And he goes, Dad, you know, I didn't want Caleb to think I'm, you know, a politician. Which is funny, until you realize there's a 12-year-old kid in Ankeny, Iowa, that is embarrassed to admit he was born in our nation's capital. Mm-hmm. So if you don't think we've got challenges as a country, and this is incumbent on all of us, there's a reason we do this, because we believe. We have a different set of principles that guide what we do, but we still believe that this is the greatest country on the planet. So I think this is incumbent on all of us when it comes to the caucus process and what we do, that let's make sure that, you know, we're carrying ourselves appropriately. And I think this is part of that process, Kevin.
Hey, Ann Roth, let me ask you one quick question before we wrap things up here. And that is in terms of the future of the Republican Party. You're a younger Republican. You know, how do you view the Republican Party of 2018, of 2020? What's going to go forward? What's going to make Republicans work in the future?
Yeah, I actually was asked to speak to this idea right after the election with a group of Republican women in the state. And as I looked around, I was on a panel with younger women, but we were speaking to an older crowd. And the thing that I couldn't stop saying is that we need to be inclusive. And I think both parties want to be that, but I think that in this last election, there were a lot of people that have been turned off by the Republican Party, women in particular. And so a main mantra that I keep on, you know, harping on and explaining when I talk to leaders is that we need to be including more people than what it seems like maybe on the surface. And so what a future party looks to me, look, our governor is a Republican woman who has a lot of fire under her, who is extremely positive and focused on women in a lot of different ways. And I think that's the stream that in Iowa I want to carry forward with her. So.
Kay Henderson, what's going to happen with media, particularly in this tough environment and trying to figure out how to cover politics in when people yell fake news and things like that? But what's going to happen with media coverage of politics?
Well, if I knew that, I would earn a lot more money than I do today.
I'm giving you your chance to do that.
Exactly. I think the 24/7 nature of our politics today just exacerbates the tribalism that you see going on between these two parties. And I'm glad most of the audience is seated, because I recently spoke to a church group. I know that's really hard for some people to believe that a journalist might go into a church. But I told this group one of the most powerful moments that I've seen this fall was a speech that Oklahoma Senator James Lankford gave to a group of Republicans. And he asked that group of evangelical Christians who identify as Republicans if they had ever invited someone of a different race to their home for dinner. And you could have heard a pin drop in that room. And a person who was sitting near the press area said, as if a light bulb had gone off above his head, "Oh, wow." And one of the things that I think we're seeing happen in our culture is that the tribes are not interacting. And Lankford could expand that question: how many of you have invited someone of the opposing political party to your home for dinner these days? Because those conversations are getting harder and harder to have as we head into Thanksgiving. Let's say a prayer for every family in America that the tribes don't face off over the turkey dinner.
Dave Yepsen.
Well, as I look ahead at 2018 and 2020 in Iowa, I get paid to try to think about, or used to get paid to try to think about what's going to happen and why. You look at the profile of the electorate in this state in 2016, older, white, rural, non-college. I've just described Iowa to you. And this state went overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. Trump ran better here than he did in Arizona or Texas. Put another way, Hillary Clinton ran better in Texas and Arizona than she did here. I'm operating under the assumption that Iowa is moving back into being a more Republican state. Many of the millennials, particularly in towns like Ottumwa and Clinton, are leaving Iowa. And the result of which is that what ought to be fertile ground for Democrats just isn't here. It's moving to other states. It's moving to places like Arizona and Texas. We have a very small, relatively small minority population. So I think that's a challenge for Democrats. I think it raises questions about whether this is Iowa will be a good place to start for Democrats to start the 2020 process. Maybe it will be bad because it doesn't fit the profile of the electorate, isn't the same as it is in the country. On the other hand, maybe it's a good place to start it because Democrats have to figure out how to talk to people in the Jefferson, Iowas of this country again. So those are things to kind of keep an eye on because I think Democrats ought to do well in 2018. They're not the party in power. That's the conventional wisdom. Trump's enormously unpopular. But the fact is, in off-year elections in this state, Republicans do a better job of turning out than Democrats do. So it could be another tough election for Democrats in 2018 in Iowa.
Thank you, David.
I was going to say, Matt Paul, with some trepidation, will give you the final word.
Thank you, Dennis, for that.
And we know what the
vote
word
of
is.
Confidence.
God help us.
I think Iowa needs to stand up and remind people why we are the best place to start this conversation. That Iowa is a place where you cannot buy it. Mm-hmm. Iowa is a place where it is not cost prohibitive. You are not spending $2 million to get 20 spots on Detroit television or whatever the market might be. This is a place where you have to go look people eye to eye and say, this is why I want to be the leader of this country. And I think depending on what happens in Iowa in 2018, this fight could get really ugly. I think if Kim Reynolds is reelected, if we do not see any gains in the Iowa House or the Iowa Senate, I think this is going to be a real fight for Democrats. I do not necessarily believe that New Hampshire is necessarily our brothers in arms in this. I think Nevada and South Carolina are. I think we should admit who we are. We should be proud of who we are. And I think Iowa will have this place, but I think it's okay if we have to stand up and remind people, you got to come here and earn it. And I think candidates should be proud to do so.
That is the first edition of Wonks. We want to thank all of the members of our panel, Matt Paul, Matt Strawn, Emily Parcell, Ann Roth, Kay Henderson, David Yepsen. We also want to say thanks to Noche Jazz Cabaret, Brandon Gedler, Max Wellman, and Maria Filippone. Josh Jepsen and Brandon Kerr are our audio engineers tonight. Our thanks to Alex Cooney for his graphics, audio production, and editing our website. And speaking of that, a reminder to visit us at iowawonks.com. We are on Facebook, Twitter, at Iowa Wonks. And don't forget, check out the podcasts on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Our next Wonks, right here, back here at Noche, December 4th. For Dennis Goldford, I'm Kevin Cooney. Thank you very much for being here tonight.